Hello, bonjour, guten Morgen. Today I'm talking to the legend of the academic study of historical European martial arts, Daniel Jacquet. And Daniel Jacquet is a Swiss martial arts researcher and historian. And I'm sharing at the moment his website, which is easy to find. If you just type Daniel Jacquet, you'll get this his personal website, which is fabulous. He's kind of be he became famous, and I will say famous because it extended beyond the realms of the academic world and into into all sorts of historical interest groups by doing serious research into what it is possible to do in a suit of armor. And there's some fabulous videos of Daniel running, long distance races, doing assault courses, comparing himself with soldiers in battle fatigues, carrying kit and firemen and so on and so on. So his website's great, but I'll just say good morning and hello, Daniel. How are you doing?
Hi Paul, thank you for having me. I'm fine. And you're right. So usually my academic career is not for what I am remembered of. Everybody thinks about the armored man running in.
And rightly so. I mean, so could you tell us a little bit about how that happened? That's the thing that you became famous is the right word. So internationally well known. You also did things like you wore the suit of armor on a transatlantic flight, didn't you? Because you realized the luggage would be so expensive and it couldn't go on as hand luggage. So you wore a suit of armor to fly to New York or somewhere. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So when it was at the Metropolitan Museum, and when he invited me, I said, "Yes, it's great. I would love to do this, but you have to count that there is extra amount of money for the carry-on luggage." He said, "Oh, it's out of budget." So I said, "Okay, so I'll do it by wearing it."
And you, what, how did you get, how did that work then? How did it pan
It was. I'll make the long story short because. Well, I started by writing to the flight company saying, "Well, hey, may I?"
out?
And they said, "Yes, if the airport security is okay." So I phoned the airport security, and they said, "Yes, we will, but only if the airplane company is all right." So it was chasing cat and mice. And then at the end of the story, they said, "Well, you have to try. If the security lets you pass, then you go in." And that was the case. So I wasn't wearing the helmet nor the gloves, which are a bit scary. But otherwise, yes. So that was it. That was fun.
Excellent. So how did it come about, and how did you get a suit of armor, and what was the story?
The story was easy. My father was willing to make me a doctor of law, and I said, "No, I want to study history. And I'm interested in fighting." And when I went down to the academic career, they found out that yeah, you have to be very, very specific in research. And of course, I was interested into what is in the impact of this weird object that is the armor. What does it mean to wear it? And since as an historian, I work with documents, so the idea was that how can you make the object talk in order to have a better understanding of the texts and the images. So that's basically what I did. And I had to find ways into getting these suits of armor. And I went to museum curators, and if we were in the 19th century, it would have been easy. I would just have worn an original one. It's no more the case today. And so I had to reconstruct one, basically. So using what they call, well, replicas. So it's an archaeological experimental endeavor. I had to contact specialists. And basically, also making the long story short, it runs down to the price and the time in order to make it, because the idea is not as a reenactor. I didn't want to have it look like a medieval suit of armor. I was willing to have a kit that actually works like the original one. And it's about the price of a car. So took me 2 years looking for funding and then getting this, and then make a lot of tests. So every test that goes with movements, also energy expenditures.
Okay. That's it's, and you kind of busted some myths, didn't you? There were general myths circulating about the capacity. Did you know that it must be the sense of a suit of armor as something that really incapacitated the knight or the wearer? Did you know that was not the case? I mean, was it known that we had a myth from certain films about that, and that it was not? What did you not know that you found out?
So there was already a great work being done in that field. It started very early in the early 20th century, and Dirk Breiding was a leading scholar now on this field. And basically, yes, it's completely because of the author of Tom Sawyer. So that's what's the name? Help me here.
The author of God, I know this one, and Huckleberry. Everyone knows this. This is embarrassing.
Yes. Yeah, it's going to come to mind. So he wrote as well a novel that Mark Twain. Thank you.
Americans are going to kill us.
Not enough coffee this morning.
Blacklisted in America. Okay.
he wrote a novel that is called The Adventures of a Connecticut Yankee in the King of Arthur's Court. And okay. In this novel, he imagined that these people, well, his character traveled to China and encounters these characters wearing armor, very complicated. It's like, it's very heavy. We don't see anything in this. When we fall down, we cannot stand up. And if you want to climb on a horse, you need a crane. Mm-hmm. And that's basically his invention. So that's fiction. But this image became very popular and was translated to movie as early as the 1940s. And since it's a very, very popular image that sticks to everybody's mind, so this is about myth busting, right? Because we have no evidence whatsoever that the cranes were used to put, to the contrary, we know we have historical text in the 15th century that says that we can jump on the horseback without using the stirrups.
Yeah. And when you came to Cardiff and we got to one of the martial arts studies conferences and you did your presentation in your suit of armor and you showed us some of the films which are available freely online now of your scientific experiments. I remember one thing that really stood out for me was that you said, actually, because of the mechanics of the hinges of the ankle and of the foot, You are more powerful and you can run faster, or there's more power because. Can you explain that a little bit? Because that I remembered that clearly, but didn't quite get it. I mean,
I'll start with the story behind. So when we did the first experiment, so there was motion capture using traditional sports science methods. We did gait analysis, so every joints were measured in time and space. On the three directions of movement, that is extension, flexion, and internal rotation, external rotation, and and when we were looking at the results of me doing the gait with and without the armor, I was sitting next to the colleague, and I said, how come do I have more motion capacity when I am in armor? And I said, it's obviously wrong. Your machine is broken. And she looked at me very angry and said, no, that's very actual. So we tried to figure that out. And that's easy. That's because of the added weight. So since you have about 40% of your weight added to you, some of your movements are greater. Okay. And that means that some of the movements, by definition, are more effective when you wear armor.
So it's like, I mean, I've noticed recently because we're all on lockdown in different ways and I can't get out to train. So I've started lifting weights again. And when I do squats with the bar across my back, the first set with no weight on the bar, it's really hard to do. By the time you put some heavy weight on, my body's much happier doing this. Is it like that or is that just something like that?
It's also something that is interesting regarding that's a critical point of view regarding evaluating experiments of people doing things like this, because there is loads of people trying to experiment with armor, whether in academic pursuit or in leisure pursuit or because it's their hobby and so whatever. And usually those people, they do their tests without either proper kits or proper training. Because mm-hmm. what happens, what I could observe during my research, is that if you wear your kit regularly, your body adapts, muscles develops. And the feeling of ease that you describe is clearly so. So your body adapts to the added weight. And if you take away the weight, then it feels weird.
Haha, that's true. So you spend a lot of time kind of going about your daily business in a suit of armor. I've seen some clips of this. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, when I received the kit, I said it's no use for just me put this on and do the tests. My body needs to be aware of this. Also, down to proprioception. So your body, your brain, and your neurons, they calculate this, mm-hmm. and it comes with habits and regular training. So when I received the suit, I said I need to wear this 2 hours a day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My wife hated me because I cannot put this myself, so I had to.
And it takes a long time, doesn't it? It takes like 45 minutes or something.
Well, we did the test. So with untrained people, I need 45 minutes. With two people that are trained, knows the stuff and know how to do it. So we calculated the time and we came to 6 minutes. So perfect. 6 minutes when you are already ready. So all the garment that you wear below are perfect and set up. Just putting the stuff is 6 minutes with two people.
Okay. What was I going to say about that? I mean, I wanted to, although I remember you also said that there was something like only one natural movement that you couldn't do. And I think it was some kind of movement of the arm. That the suit of armor wouldn't accommodate, but you said that's kind of fine because for fighting or horse riding, it's absolutely not required.
So when we did the movements of the test, the idea was to explore natural movements as well as what they called functional movements. So all the movements tested to the highest possible capacity, mm-hmm. and some of movements are impaired, like this one, uh-huh. are really impaired, but this one is completely free. What is interesting is the way that I tie these observation with the study of the text, because we have technical text in the Middle Ages, those kind of fight books, mm-hmm. Very specific literature. Maybe we're going through describing this during this talk. Mm-hmm. And in this, we see movements are described, and this one is not a movement that you use.
So fighting. The vertical, you can't put your hands up to surrender.
No. Yes, you can do this. What you cannot do is this.
Okay. You can't put your arm straight up. So can you do a downward strike with a weapon or the hammer fist? Or you can do that.
Yes. Yes, but that's very dangerous because you expose a weakness here. This is one of the weaknesses of the armor. So you don't want this, and you don't need this movement to actually strike down. This movement is completely free. That's fine.
Right.
This okay, movement, I'm gonna this just, movement, no. This is for Hollywood movies, like you want to strike down your enemy and split the enemy in half with the horse.
Yeah, I'm gonna talk through the movements because I've just remembered that although we're videoing this, some of it goes on a podcast, the audio goes on a podcast. So Daniel's saying you can't put your hands vertically straight above your head, but you could do a bent arm kind of downward strike. You couldn't do the classic Hollywood kind of holding the sword in two hands and striking straight down like a kendo strike.
Yes.
But because there's an elbow, there's a weakness in the armpit because there's no armor there anyway.
And also the most efficient thing you want to do when you're wearing a late 15th century armor kit, you can't do anything. Oh, sorry. This is live disturbance. Yeah, I'm gonna turn down the volume of this.
Interesting to know what that ringtone would be.
Yeah. So, yes, what you want to do is stick your point into the weakness of the armor. In order to do this, you need to push your sword. And that's exactly what the offensive movement that describes is this. And this is completely free with the armor. This is restricted. This is free.
Okay. So a more powerful stabbing kind of a...
Yeah.
So... you mentioned people who are into HEMA, historical European martial arts, as hobbies and as kind of amateur researchers. I mean, what's your relationship with the people who do battle recreation or who do kind of HEMA things for fun. I mean, I know that you often have competed in these competitions. Which came first for you, the sort of academic interest or the fun combative recreation aspect, which was first?
I would love to return the question. So what is your topic of research, and are you a martial artist? So
never you mind, I asked the question.
Yes. No, try to mixing them, but to understand when I play with sword, which I do, I don't do academic research. Mm-hmm. When I have my hat of researchers, I ask specific questions to what I do, and I observe this and I document it. Mm-hmm. When I'm playing with swords, I don't go through these endeavors of documenting, observing, putting methodological frame in order to do this, but one helps the other. Without one, I could not do the other one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. How long a history does HEMA itself, not the historical field, but the growth of popular interest in historical European martial arts, what's the kind of history of that? Like, when did it really become a popular thing? Mm.
So maybe we have to break down this a bit. So we're talking about a community of people willing to fight, like in the Middle Ages. These are reenactors, usually, since a very, very long time, and we didn't wait to have the 21st century to have this. This goes long back to history. What is very specific, and what I think you refer to, is this community of practitioners who labels himself between this HEMA thing, so H-E-M-A, Historical European Martial Arts. In the beginning of my academic career, I was trying to say, okay, how come, or how would I explain that what I do is not this, but it is scientific research? And maybe we have to take the H out of this. So if we're talking about the object of study, we can call this European martial arts. If we're talking about the documents, we're talking about fight books. And if we're talking about the community of practitioners try to recreating this or doing serious studies about this, and then we can call this HEMA. And to go down to your questions, when was it a thing? I think the first wave that we could call historical European martial arts began in the 19th century, same times as Mark Twain, when they started when the Olympic movement started to go big, and turning, well, the invention of combat sports, basically. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of interest into, well, come on, this is related to a past, mm-hmm. or this is related to something that people can identify themselves with. Mm-hmm. So I think the beginning in the context of Europe about this started really in the last decade of the 19th century.
So is it connected with a kind of nationalism, a search for cultural roots and cultural memory?
Completely. Yeah, completely. Okay. Yeah. Going back to what you were discussing with Ben Judkins, it's exactly there. So it's the same, but in Europe.
Okay. And I mean, are there any, I always worry about a search for historical roots, because ideologically, I know this is my fear, this is my exaggerated kind of oversensitive response to it, but in my opinion, a desire for cultural roots can often lead to a fantasy about a kind of ethnic past, mm-hmm. like the true English or true British or true Germanic, and that bothers me because it's, that to me is a hair's breadth away from racism or ethno-nationalism. I mean, obviously there are going to be practitioners who indulge in these kinds of fantasies and these kinds of dreams and so on, but do you think that the practices are more self-aware than that, or am I stigmatizing practitioners by worrying about their politics or whether they're racist or not? What do you think?
Yeah, there has been huge discussion online, especially on social networks. People expressing those fears, mm-hmm. and people reacting or overreacting over those. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Also, the problem is that people using the studies that are made or the rediscoveries or this documentation to try to put this to an argument to an agenda that is not the one of people studying this is dangerous, mm-hmm. because then there are some association with this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we are kind of, can you say prudent or precautious? And yes, what you describe, we have groups trying to link this to an heritage that is their own. And you can clearly see the same thing that you can see in the 1930s or 40s happening again.
It's a funny process, isn't it? It's a funny risk, because it's hard to articulate it unless you've really theorized the problems of racism and the problems of kind of cultural bigotry. A friend of mine, I won't mention his name, and I won't mention the social media, and I won't, but I'll be as vague as possible. He's not an academic, and he won't listen to this, but he might. He once was advocating the view that he'd found somewhere that, like, you know, the thing about Roman roads being straight, long and straight, arguing that actually the Romans just reused roads that had been established by Celts, and they were actually like Celtic roads. And I'm like, no, why do you want this to be true? Like, why do you want it to have been an indigenous people who did this rather than a migrant kind of colonizing imperial group of foreigners, I suppose? Well, you know, it's just like, it's why do you want it to be your ethnicity? It worries me. But by the same token, when you think about, there's a lot of stuff written about East Asian martial arts, mm-hmm. and scholars who've written about the popularity of Chinese and Japanese martial arts in the 1970s argued that it was a good thing because it enabled a kind of cross-cultural identification. So the equation goes cross-cultural identification, good, monocultural identification, bad. Do we buy that equation or is that something that you've thought about or worried about? Or
It's like a shield to easy critics, I think. It's the same about developing. I am a lot thinking, reading and researching now into this intangible cultural heritage.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of potential dangers over there, because one of the thing that you want, if you want to present any activity or tradition or whatever, this is a complicated word, tradition, but whatever physical activity that is tied to an intangible cultural heritage, you have to show how people practicing it are actually tying this to an identity. Mm-hmm. And that's your problem.
Yeah.
Especially if in the case of historical European martial arts or European martial arts, people have this great corpus of documents, and it's easy to say, well, this one was produced at that time, so it was practiced in this village in 1410.
Yeah,
it's not really the case. So there is a lot of discussion that we have to have or to deconstruct, mm-hmm. before we can make such statements. Mm-hmm. For who was it produced? What's the type of documents? What's the relation between this document to the actual practice? And most of the time, it's impossible to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that I came up with a term that kind of sums up my worries about historically focused kind of either martial practice, martial fantasy, martial study. And the term I came up with was the idea of an origin destination. Like, so the historical approach is often desperate to find the origin. This, mm-hmm. this is a simplification, because the historical approach probably isn't. It's more like the origin story, the desire for the moment of origin, like the person who dreamed up the martial art, or, you know, the lineage that we identify with. Because as you say, it's tied It's tied often problematically with a desire for cultural identity or a sense of cultural identity. And my worry is that if we're focused on the origin, which I guess historians aren't, historians are focused on complex processes of transformation and so on. But if we're focused on the origin, then that becomes the destination and everything other than that is inferior to it. But I guess actual proper historians, as opposed to maybe like even martial artist fantasists, and I include myself in this group, because I have in the past fully fantasized about the practice that I am involved in when I have done Tai Chi or Kung Fu. I've fantasized about misty mountains and ancient China and all of this stuff. But it is, the historical approach is very different to that, yeah?
Mm. Well, it depends. It's easy to... it's difficult to put labels there, because if you say scientific approach, critical approach to history of a document, includes this the question of where it was produced and when. Doesn't mean that the material that is in is actually tied to this date and place. And people often work with what is available without having the big picture. It's you asked before when HEMA became a thing. I was speaking about the 19th century, but there was something happening in the 1990s. And since 20 years now, maybe internet is to blame. So easy access to documentation without critical apparatus or documents. It's easy to find. People take all of this material, they fill up their hard disk or computer and make association with this that an historian would not make.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a discourse. And it's very difficult to then go against this discourse saying, hey guys, maybe you should have reconsidered this or this aspect. And they would not, this is something that happens to me a lot because I'm tied to this community. I lecture for them, I do workshops internationally. And when I raise my voice and put my hat as an academic and say, hey, maybe we should get a step back. People are not willing to go to do this because they are pleased to have this, as you the same thing that you described before, the fantasy, the will that what we are doing now is exactly what they have done in 1546 in London. Unsure.
So I guess. You're suggesting that maybe some of what's required, the frustrating thing is to take a more sophisticated approach to the texts, because the text is a complicated object that it's difficult to establish who it was written by, who it was written for, where they'd gathered that knowledge, whether it was a kind of fantasy, whether it's an ideal, whether they're describing something in general, or whether they're proposing something new that maybe didn't catch on. I mean, I guess just because you've got a 14th or 15th century text, you're missing a lot of the attending discourse, like whether this was a radical eccentric proposition or whether this was a... So you've got to kind of cross-reference it with so many other factors, many of which I'm guessing are absent, right? For certain. Yes. Yeah.
I think you're completely correct. And just before this, I think the first danger is that I've taken a book with me.
Yes.
That's a scientific edition, and this is the second volume, and inside, so just people who doesn't know what this is or what a fight book looks like, they can see. So you have text, textual instruction and illustration. And this describes technical movements, which is martial arts. Now people that discover this, they have to access the language. If you go on internet, you will find translation, most of the time made by practitioners, not by a scholarly approach. And you have tons of issues there. So this is not a manual. You cannot just take this, read it, replicate the movement and say that you are doing wrestling technique from the middle 15th century by doing this. So because they probably were not meant as manual.
Yeah. work out the function of that text. I always remember there's a line in Walter Benjamin somewhere, probably in like the Task of the Translator, and he argues that we never translate the text like into its own terms. We always modify the text because we translate historical text into terms that we understand. Mm-hmm. So and for our concerns, or even a cross-cultural text, we translate the text from another language into terms that make sense in this culture. So we are by definition and unavoidably necessarily changing it. Like there is no original text in the sense that it was always, so Jacques Derrida's term of difference is always deferring, its meaning is always differing, it's always, and that's a very frustrating, but also enabling kind of a fact, isn't it? It's like our ontological relationship with a text is one of, we can probably get quite certain-ish if we can bring in other factors around there, but in historical European martial arts, so much is missing that we always have that leap of imaginative invention. Mm-hmm. You think?
Yes. I think you put the word that we haven't done it before, invention. Yeah. Historical European martial arts is invented practice, reinvented practice based on historical documents. Mm-hmm. And the agenda of people doing this, they don't want to actually do an historical study of that text, and they don't care about all the issues that we were mentioning before. What they want is to do the martial arts.
Yeah.
In order to do this, they have to adapt it to their context, to their environment. Mm-hmm. And this is then reinvention. Of course it is a reinvention.
Here's a question, and this is something that I know this is probably a conundrum. It's one of these riddles of the ages, but do you think as a practitioner of a range of martial arts and user of many different sorts of weapons, that there is something, so let's get something. So we'll get something basic, right?
Yes.
This is a length of rattan, right? This is your basic Eskrima weapon, okay? Or Kali, or, but anywhere that you can have. This is a stick, a straight stick. Is there something inherent in the way that this, that its parameters and its limitations of use and for use? Or is there something that this piece of material technology brings that is limited? So let's say you pick up a battle axe or a cudgel or something from a historical period, or nunchakus, rice flails, or anything, or a bow staff or a quarter staff. Are its parameters prescribed in its relationship with the human body, or is it always invented? Can you work out how they would use a staff in ancient times?
Well, the first layer of thing you can do is try to identify what was the object meant to be used in historical documentation. Mm-hmm. And this is often leads to wild guess. Oh yes, of course, I've seen people on internet measuring the length of the sword on a medieval image. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, this is nice, but yeah, you have to understand the medieval image first, right? Yeah. this is not a photographic document. You could do it on the photographic documents. You cannot do this on the medieval illustration. So to go back to your question, it's very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. To make that association. I had the same issue in my research, like how do I choose a suit of armor that would fit what is illustrated in my documents? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is there any technological elements or specific things that would change the movements according to the type of objects? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. But the problem is that how do you document this? How? Too difficult. I would say that what I do are interpretive tryouts. Mm-hmm. And in order to get to something that you will not be able to aim to something that you cannot have. In order to minimize this, then you multiply the approach and you cross-reference them. And then you can say, I'm closer to where I was willing to go. But these are the limits of my approach because it's based on documentation, not on objects, blah, blah, blah.
I guess you can try to establish certain probabilities. There's lots of different kinds of studies you could do. I mean, I was just thinking about even talking about the basic propensity of the human body. There's no one propensity and there's no one body. I mean, someone could be injured. Like, you know, you often get this. Remember when we went to a conference in Trier organized by Eric Burkhart and Eva Bischoff, and Greg Downey was there, and he was talking about the kind of the Eurocentrism of certain sociobiological understandings of combat, and the idea that the fist is natural. There was that now, fortunately, kind of refuted argument that this was the fist is an evolutionary kind of feature. So the fist is not for grabbing, the fist is for punching, and therefore boxing is somehow like the natural degree zero of human combat. But I mean, and it's just nonsense because it's such a cultural thing. And as Greg Downey argued, like it's the existence of boxing gloves that give it the dominance that it has. If you take away boxing gloves, people won't box, you know, other fists become more valid in other parts of the body. But even like I have a body and I think I've got one body, but even if I'm just doing basic boxing, jab, cross, hook, I probably won't hook because I've had so many shoulder injuries. I just won't throw that punch. For me, it would be an uppercut. So if I was teaching someone and I didn't have a pedagogical principle other than what works for me, I would never teach people to do a hook, never, because it hurts my shoulders, you know? So massive digression.
I would like to tie this to a discussion that we had with colleagues. I think the Swedish gymnastic was mentioned in your talk with Ben. So as a thing of this national exhibition of demonstration of martial practice. Mm-hmm. This is still something that I find in the gym today of people doing HIMA. What they do basically is that the instructor or the people interpreting those texts, mm-hmm. he finds the ideal movement and he tries to give this back to the students in order to replicate. This is what you would need to do if you want to succeed in replicating this movement. Mm-hmm. It's not the case. This is a construct of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Even I have in this documentation in the 16th century, I have an author who writes down, very progressive, that every technique in his book should be adapted to one's body.
Okay.
There you have it. Yeah. 1570 is published in Strasbourg, Joachim Meyer.
Yeah.
Very progressive martial artist instructor.
Okay. So speaking of progressive, you are currently working on, and you've got loads of different projects on the go, haven't you? Wayne, what are your ongoing projects at the moment?
I would like, I have an application going on to a project that has been on since at least 2 or 3 years. If I get this, I think we can go down to the path. I've labeled this as experimental history. What I hate is that people mix what HIMA is. We don't do experimental archaeology. This is not the case, because if you do experimental archaeology, you start with an object and you try to replicate the object, and the process in recreating the object then goes back to the original object. This is perfect established methodology, scientific ever, no issues. We cannot do this with martial arts. There is no object that contains the information about the gesture. Mm-hmm. So we need another workaround. If we want to go down to understanding those texts, because this is what I try to aim at, is understanding these documents and what are their relation with technique du corps, if we can call this. In order to do this, we have to define new methods. And these methods, they integrate experiments, experiences. So there is a difference between experiencing and experimenting. Mm-hmm. And I would like to try out the current project, his experimental history, with a set of texts ranging from the 14th century to the 19th century, and compare the different elements. And the end of the story there, the end product or the output, is to find out and understand better the way that people wrote down body techniques through time. What is the cultural layers on this? Is there something in relation with technology? Is there something in relation with and so on. And that would be a 5-year project, and hopefully starting in 2021, if everything goes as planned.
You're currently working on another project, which is on martial arts in medieval towns. Is that ongoing? Yes,
this is ongoing. This is a research project with a small team. This is very strong. The field is history, so it's archival documents. So basically what I try to do there or achieve is connecting technical literature such as fight book or other traces of bodily technique with other type of sources, administrative sources, legal sources in the towns, exploring how martial culture has helped turning the towns that were motors of the modern state between the late 15th century and the early 16th century in the context of Switzerland and neighboring spaces.
Okay. Fascinating. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
This is great. Yeah.
You're also organizing a major international conference for next year, which is still kind of embryonic, but it's something to look out for, right?
Yes. You have to wait 2 weeks and then you'll have a website.
2 weeks and a website, yes. And we know this to be true. And we're going to be discussing this once we finish this this recording. We're going to stay online and chat about this exciting new conference for next year. So I guess, Daniel, don't hang up, but I'm going to say thank you and I'm going to stop recording. So thank you, Daniel Jacquet.
Thank you, Paul.